If I may, before I begin, I'd like to share a few personal words with you. This has been a most affirming experience for me, and I thank you for the kind of welcome I have received. It is really a very pleasant group to be part of. And I have a feeling that there are more Missouri Synod people here than stood up, or at least you're the most friendly people here, because it seems everyone who introduces themselves to me went to Concordia Seward at one point. Last night in those who came to the fireside talk, we talked a little bit about the shadow study, the study of theological education, which goes along with the study of ministry and will make decisions about how theological educational resources are allocated in this country and how we're going to shape our seminary life. And you should know that one of the 9 members on that commission is from this region. Pastor Charlie Mays has been elected as secretary of that group. Finally, go to the hearings that are close to you this week. Participate in the study of ministry and support your seminaries by a timely gift. That's my all your seminaries. These are difficult times for seminaries in the Missouri Synod and in the ELCA. And supporting through you the gifts of your congregation and also personal gifts is timely. We have been making connections between ministry and mission. And this morning, we're going to ask the question, is ministry as we have defined it adequate to meet the mission challenges as we see them coming at us in the rest of this century and in the century to come? Well, what I intend to do is lay out from where I sit what look like, at least it's certainly not an exhaustive list, but a list of the challenges that seem to be facing us in terms of mission in this time. And then see if there are some ways to expand our structures of ministry to meet those needs. So first, a list of challenges, and I'm glad it's early in the morning. As I read over it, I got kind of tired just thinking about the challenges that face us. First, this church has committed itself, or the ELCA has committed itself, to be a inclusive, multicultural church, to reach out across cultural boundaries to those who have not traditionally been part of our family. I think the Missouri Synod has probably done a better job on that for a longer time. But that is a challenge that we're facing in a big way. In my office there, much time being devoted to developing alternative routes to ministry, to try to create and fund internship settings in inner city or Hispanic neighborhoods. We are working on the development of Asian, Black, Hispanic, and Native American leadership. We have added staff to our division to help with the recruitment of people from those communities and to work with seminaries so that to work towards making those years of training less alienating. But it is a task for the whole church, for us in synods to be reaching out to those communities, but also in the predominantly white congregations that most of you, I expect, serve. Are those becoming places that will be able to receive the leadership of these multicultural leaders that we are recruiting? I have grave ethical questions about whether we as a church or as churches are ready to fully embrace the leaders who we are working so hard to recruit and support? And will a ministry for a Native American candidate, will the ministries in suburban and pleasant residential areas in Seattle, will they be open to all the candidates for the church? So that's part of your part of that challenge, to be building congregations who are able to receive leadership that is different than they are. Second challenge that I see in our church, in this country where population has shifted, you have experienced an influx of population and industry to the west, and population is moving to the southwest and the south. That is leaving areas that have been areas of great Lutheran strength in a situation of being diminished economically and in terms of growth. We've had a lot of jokes about Minnesota here, but Minnesota has been a lot of the Lutheran church in this country. And while we're reaching out to the edges and touching people who have not been part of the family before, which is certainly our mandate and is certainly the hope in terms of growth of the church, we also have an obligation to be faithful in those to those ministries in North Dakota, where there are fewer and fewer people and smaller congregations. How are those places going to be served? And they're needing increasingly complex kind of ministry. That area is called the Dirt Belt, like the industrial areas of the Northeast is called the Rust Belt. And in diminishing communities, what is the role of the church in terms of reaching out with social programs, engendering hope, and maintaining community in those areas where it's not much fun to serve right now, and where it's a real challenge to seminarians to be willing to take calls in those places? Third, just very much to the point in this region of the country, newer news in other parts of the country that we are in a time of religious pluralism. And you've maybe had that all along here. We're dealing with an increasing unchurched population. You know pretty well what that's all about in the Northwest. But we have a mission to the North American continent where cultural Christianity cannot be assumed, if it ever could have been. So we need in our seminaries and in continuing education, and as you face the kind of ministries that you are doing, we need to focus on biblical literacy. People you know just don't know the stories. Basic instruction, preaching for conversion, apologetics. We need to be doing first order evangelism, not only in multicultural communities, but that is going to be more and more the norm of our ministry, rather than gathering in historic Lutherans or even historic Christians. A fourth challenge I see is not only do people not know the Christian stories, a lot of people aren't reading any stories at all. We may be entering a post-literate age where you can't count on a common cultural background of people having read the same literature or participate in worship or in education in your congregations at a literate level. We are very much a church of the book, and it is a big adjustment for us to learn how we bring the word to people who see in images who mostly watch television. We need to learn to communicate orally, visually. We need to learn more how to use the mass media as a church. Fifth challenge I see is the challenge to connect faith to daily life, particularly in terms of occupation and life orientation. We need to learn more and more, not that you're not doing it all. I don't mean to lay a bunch of stuff on you as though you've never heard of this. But the need is, I think, becoming more acute. People are becoming more demanding that the word that we speak is relevant to their lives. And that means we need to know more about their lives. We need to be able to make the connections to people who live in a high-tech scientific culture. And most of us weren't very well prepared to operate in those circles and are a little skittish about even entering into those conversations. We need to be able to minister not only to the illiterate that I mentioned before, but also, for goodness sakes, to the highly literate, to the highly competent decision makers in business, economics, government, scientific fields, to address the leisure class, well-educated, competent people who have served in a variety of important positions in the culture, who now have time on their hands and money to spend, and is the church sufficiently challenging to them, meaningful to their lives, that we're going to be able to hold these people and that faith will continue to be a vital force in their lives. I see also the challenge of global interdependence, Professor Chung has mentioned, the challenge to be able to proclaim the faith with a kind of global consciousness, to be able to relate to the people in our congregations who work in businesses and corporations that span the world, to be able to do the Copernican revolution in our own mind that our culture and our country are not the heartbeat of the universe, that we are not the center, that things are shifting to the south. That is a big turnaround for us to do, but that's part of the world that we live in and that our people live in, and we need to be with it. We need to be open and alert to receive mission in reverse as part of a global church. We need to be open to receive the theology that's coming from Latin America. We need to be open to share in and learn from the evangelism in Africa. We need to be alert to the dialogue with world religions that's going on in Asia. And what we've got an occasion to do that at this meeting. So that's a lot of stuff, and that's just some things I've thought of. You could probably add more. And you face those kind of challenges demanding that we be rather extraordinary, expanded kind of people in the face of some real difficulties, I think, within the ministry and within the church. One, we're facing all that with, I think, fewer numbers. These are tricky to predict, but all indications are that we are facing a shortage of clergy. It won't happen everywhere, as I said last night. It'll probably happen last in Seattle. But we are, last year at the assignment of students, something between two-thirds and three-fourths of the calls that were available to people coming out of seminary were able to be filled with candidates. Now, that may be good news in the short run. That sounds like more mobility, perhaps not mobility in large cosmopolitan areas or in the regions of the country that are most desirable to serve. But it is a worry for the church as a whole. It's related to many issues. Why are there less clergy? It's related to issues of clergy mobility. There are clergy who would like to serve who can't get to the areas where they feel they need to be. The pressures of two career families is making it more difficult for people to serve. The pull to urban areas, more person or family-centered lifestyles. We're having more pastors coming to ministry later as a second career, which of course means there are fewer years to serve. We also, and I don't have statistics on this, but it's certainly my impression that we have more and more pastors leaving ministry and taking second careers in other lines of work. And that should be an open door, but it diminishes the numbers of people that we have to do the work. We have more pastors desiring non-parish or post-parish ministry. We have pastors who are struggling with their own faith and with the possibility of hanging on to their integrity and honesty as pastors of the church, deep wounds and struggles that I know many of you are going through. We also, maybe for all the reasons above, and also because we have said that there is a oversupply of pastors, we haven't done a very good job of recruiting people to go into the ministry. And that's a challenge to you. Now is the time. There are gifted people in your congregation who ought to think about ministry in the church. See that you talk to them. We haven't done that. We are going to be church-wide, are going to be encouraging bishops and pastors to do that. That shouldn't be the work of the seminaries to recruit people for ministry. That's our job as the church, to raise up leaders and discern who those leaders will be. And you, as pastors and leaders in congregations, are key people in doing that. But it's hard to do if it's not going very well for you right now. So, we've got all these challenges, and it looks like fewer numbers to do that. I also feel keenly, and it's not news, it's just coming in on me a little more intensely, low trust in the organized church as an adequate vehicle for the gospel. Authority of the church and its offices are undermined by mistrust and perception of unresponsiveness, irrelevance, hierarchy, bureaucracy, the works. I think we may be facing a crisis in what we used to call churchmanship, and I haven't come up with a less sexist term for it. But I think we're past the time where cheap shots at the church are where we can afford that. I think we need, among our congregations and among ourselves, to be calling the church to account and putting our money where our mouth is and our bodies into supporting the church as a whole. Bishop Chilstrom has said in the 60s, we didn't trust anyone over 30. In the 80s, we don't trust anyone over 30 miles away. And I think we need. And finally, the last bad news, I see and I hear of decreased congregational involvement and volunteerism due to a million things, to changing lifestyles, more two-career families, women's growing sense of the value of their work, the breakdown in communal structures and commitments, the individualism that we've talked about these days, changes in the habits of the heart. And I expect you feel up here keenly the lure of recreational opportunities as competition to the kind of educational and service and fellowship activities that might have been the heart and center of people's lives. I hear people asking, are there alternative communities, assemblies of believers that make more sense than traditional congregations? And that's, I don't know if you're hearing talk like that, but people, highly committed Christians, are making their commitments sometimes beyond the local congregation. So what do we do about all that? One could, and many have, proposed many remedies to meet these challenges. I don't pretend that they're new or that the remedies are. The first one is usually, at least in my frame of reference, is to cram a few more courses into the seminary curriculum. If you have all these things to do and it's a little overwhelming, well then shove another course on stewardship or care of the environment or multicultural ministry into those 3 years of seminary. And then if that, right behind that is continuing education, which can also provide a million opportunities like this for you to be energized to do all those things. Another approach is for the church to provide a steady stream of materials for you to meet the challenge. We can provide programs, literature, research, position papers, strategies for meeting the mission. We can call on, and we ought to call on, the finest minds to help think through approaches to these problems. And we ought to mobilize bishops to be more personally responsive to their clergy in terms of mobility and congregational conflict, more visionary in their leadership, more supportive of you when you are being visionary. We ought to raise up a cadre of confidential counselors for clergy who can help you through the crises and ward off the exhaustion and despair. Of course, all this must be done, and more. But people are working on it, and people have been working on it for years. And we're committed, all of us, again and again, to do it better and better. I know those people. You know those people. The people are scattered through this room. Church executives, seminary faculty, synod officials are easy whipping boys and now whipping girls. And they help often by flagellating themselves before you get there. We need to be held accountable, but there is only so much you can squeeze out of a turnip. They are as tired as you are. Lots of people are working to make this system of parish-based pastoral ministry work. We can ask these people to work harder and better, but there is a time when you have to stop and ask, is the system itself workable for these times and for the times to come? Can the pastors do it all? Should they? If not, who will? It seems like we have an occasion here. The study for ministry is a big occasion to do it. They're big questions. They'd be lucky if they're resolved in 5 or 6 years. But I'm going to make a stab at it. I don't see the pastoral office changing. It is my conviction and maybe my vested interest that we will always need pastors with the gifts and the authority particular to that office. And I have a very high view of what a pastor is and needs to be. Pastor needs to have the intellect to master the academic study of theology once in seminary and throughout their lives to stay alive and thinking leading in theological reflection. Pastors need to have a capacity for leadership, more than one-on-one, leadership capacity to organize and inspire large groups of people. Pastors need emotional strength, probably in unusual quantities, emotional strength to sustain continual stress, disruption of their lives, and the needing, as Kara said, to only unwind your wounds one at a time so that you're ready to meet the crises in other people's lives. More wear and tear and stress than most people in the society are willing or want to put up with in terms of having a whole lifestyle. Pastors, as I see it, and as the church continually reaffirms, need to be of high character. They need to have the character to live a public life as a model for others. A tall order in a privatized and individualized society, that your life is an open book and you are a model for others. And finally, on my list, we need pastors who are free to serve where they're called, who are disengaged a little from this world and able to go where the need is. And why do you need all those things? I say for the sake of the mission, so that people can come to believe and live their faith. Mission belongs to the whole people. The particular part for ordained pastors is to fulfill that mission in and through a local assembly, usually a congregation. And for that group, the pastor needs to be trusted, trustworthy, to speak the word rightly, to preside at the sacraments, to represent the unity of the whole church in space, to be more than a regional, localized person, but to represent the breadth of the church, and also the depth in time. There needs to be somebody in a congregation who knows the history, who knows why the Nicene Creed reads as it does, who can get behind that because they have plumbed the depths of the tradition. We need someone. We need pastors. People need to be able to trust someone, to be a link to the tradition, that it goes deeper and beyond the memory of that particular congregation, and to tie that particular congregation to all the other assemblies. The little church I served in Earlville, Iowa, we learned to get along pretty good, and I loved those people a lot, and that they liked me. You know, they gave me a quilt when I left and all of that. But I think they would have been more comfortable with someone more like them. If they could have raised up someone from their midst, there would have been a lot less tension. But I think they really needed me. If they had been able to raise up their own local leaders, I think in a couple of generations, they would have gotten kind of funny and isolated. And in a few more generations, I propose they would have lost the gospel. You need an influx of someone coming in who has touch with a wider world, even though that inevitably creates a little alienation. So I say that's the reason for all this great education. That's the reason for insisting on the mobility and the freedom to move across the church. That's the reason for the symbolic significance of the exemplary life. Ordained pastors are accountable both to bishops and to their congregations by virtue of their office, regardless of their individual talents or proclivities. So I think we need those kind of leaders. And I don't know, we never did have too many of those. We'll never have enough of those kind of leaders. But pastors, even those special people, cannot, and I would say should not, do the whole, be responsible for the whole mission alone. So where is the help, and with whom should that ministry be shared? The obvious, and in the language of my, post-college-age children now, the politically correct and ideologically sound answer is the priesthood of all believers, of course. The whole people of God, not just the pastors, all of us, the pastors are included in the whole people of God, eventually will be the ones to rebuild the economies of the upper Midwest, make the church hospitable to those who are different from us, bring the faith to the workplace, make the gospel compelling and believing to our secular friends. Those are things that we all need to be about. The challenge belongs to the whole people, of course. But the whole people are also part of the problem, part of the challenge of the current system of pastoral ministry. Who are they, these whole people of God? Some of them are highly committed, competent lay ministers in your church who are partners with you already. There are also many who are members of our church who need more ministering too than they can do ministering. And I don't want them written out. There's got to be room in this church for the less than fully active, for the people on the fringes, for the adherents to be ministered to and exist in a congregation while they grow in faith. So we can't count on everyone to be partners all at once. And the priesthood of all believers, your lay partners in your ministry, need to be convinced of their identity, of their mission. They need to be equipped for it, enabled, supported, exhorted, taught, organized, visited, recruited, commissioned, blessed, and it largely comes back to you again. It falls to the pastors who are going to be spread increasingly thin with less dependable congregational support, less residual authority to draw on, and little upward mobility to look forward to. How about that? So where's the help again? I think we're running out of time. We're probably not going to. I look for help to the specialized ministries and to commissioned, ordained, whatever they're going to be, lifting up new kinds of ministry. I think the people are there. I think the direction lies in the help of lifting up, preparing, authorizing, rewarding an army of ministers whose many ministries will meet the many parts of the challenge in partnership with ordained pastors. Their ministries will be more specialized than the parish pastors. Their commitments may be more circumspect in terms of length of time or service or ability to move. Their preparation may be more focused, less formal. And I will list a number of areas where I think these people are needed. There are those, some of you here, some who I've talked to, have all the commitment, experience, trustworthiness, education, or capacity to get the education that a pastor has, but do not feel gifted or called to preach and preside at sacraments, to have the oversight of a congregation, to take on the symbolic trappings of ministry and the burdens of authority. There are people among you who feel called to teach, to do theological research, to do music, to assist in congregations. And we as a church dare not cut ourselves off from your ministry or leave you without the recognition and particular legitimate authority that you need to do your ministry. just because your ministry and your sense of call doesn't fit the general category. So I think we need to do a better job on legitimizing those rather traditional lay ministries. But there's a bunch of other stuff we need to do. We need, in this church, if we are going to fulfill our mission on the North American continent, we need to be able to raise up indigenous leaders, catechists, evangelists, who know the language and the culture of the communities to which they, from which they come and to whom they could minister, who may not have a college degree or the other qualifications to be an associate ministry. There are churches, so we need to tackle that. There are also churches unable to support full-time pastors in areas of the country where population is diminishing. Pastors in those situations could be assisted by teams of specialists who are experts in things that those communities need. Experts in agriculture or economy or community organizing or counseling might be very useful in Western Nebraska right now. If we're serious about reaching populations that have not been of our educated middle class variety, we probably need some less classically educated and classically socialized ministers who might be better than us at first level evangelism, at approaching the unchurched, at witnessing. Fourth, in the workplace, maybe pastors aren't the best people to make all those links. They might help other people make them, but we might need something like industrial chaplains. It may be that shared time ministries will be more effective in bridging the gap between people's faith and their workplace. How are we going to, each of us in our own way, gather the global experience that we need to relate to this global world? But there's lots of people who have it. There are returning missionaries. There are visitors from other countries, people who can do this globalizing work more effectively than pastors can. And we shouldn't maybe put it on ourselves to do everything. Let someone else help. Give their gifts, be the experts. The challenge to ministry in the 90s did not seem to be simply the challenge to preach the word and administer the sacraments in congregational settings. That surely is the heart of it. But it is going to happen in a very diverse context, and it's going to be a very complex task. We need learned, ordained leaders who know the depth of the Christian tradition, who know its history and ancient languages, who can interpret the scripture in the light of the finest scientific scholarship, who have a sense of the Catholicity of the church throughout the world, who understand the specific heritage of the denomination. But perhaps we cannot afford, nor do we need, one of those people for every congregation of 150 or 200 people. We need ordained pastors who by nature and by intentional formation are both visionary leaders and humble patient servants, but perhaps it is not good stewardship of those very rare people to put two or three or five in one parish just because that parish can afford it. We need ordained pastors who are free to serve wherever the church calls them so that the gospel may be preached in every place and the unity of the church preserved. But it is not necessary, nor humane, nor practical to require that sacrifice of every minister, nor can we afford to lose the ministry of those who need to stay put. We need many other ministers who are particularly gifted at making the connections between the faith and people in the many places where they live and work. For such ministers, a 4-year period of intensive academic preparation and pastoral formation may be a detriment to relating to the neighborhood that they grew up in. A lifelong commitment to work in the church may isolate them from those who work outside. A year-long course in Bible and theology, together with an in-depth knowledge of technology or economics or psychology or international politics, might make the most effective minister for some contexts to meet some challenges. Well, that kind of opens it wide open. I'm not going to answer all the other questions like, will these ministers have the authority they need to do their work? Will they receive fair and adequate financial support? And where is that coming from if congregations are the only people who actually put money into the pot? How will they be held accountable? How will they be ordained? Will they be certified? How will this affect pastoral ministry? Those I see as the questions that you can bring your wisdom to at the hearings next week that the study of ministry needs to answer in the next 5 years. In a book that John Ruman put out before he knew he was going to be the chair of the study of ministry, he laid out what might be the 4 options for how ministry of the laity could be organized. I think they are very useful for us sorting out. I'm very close to the end. So 4 ways we could do this. We could do pretty much what we're doing now, which is ordain some to ministry of word and sacrament and commission others to lay professional ministries, whether we call them AIMS or lay professional ministries or church staff workers. In terms of the authority categories that we've been working with, that if we choose to leave things pretty much as they are, that invests significant legitimate authority in the pastoral office and considerably less in the commissioned offices of the church. The second option is to ordain many ministers to a variety of ministries. We might have ordained pastors, ordained teachers, ordained deacons, ordained ministers of music. I think this is the model. We hear about the threefold office of ministry, that we would have ordained bishops, ordained presbyters or pastors, and ordained deacons. But there might be other, if everything is possible, there might be other ordained ministers that certainly would increase the legitimate authority of what we have heretofore called lay ministries. But I expect they would be ranked in some way, like bishops, pastors, and deacons. The third option that's possible is to keep one order of ministry, one office of ministry, one office of word and sacrament, and ordain all kinds of people to it, that there would be one office, but people would have many different functions within it. One office of word and sacrament, and within that office, allow a broad variety of specialized ministries to be authorized. Now, in a way, after one does their 3 years of initial service in a parish, that may be rather close to what we have. There are people doing a relatively broad range of ministries as ordained people in our church. I suppose one of the decisions that our church could make on the recommendation of the study is to expand that office even wider, and then I assume all those people would have the same status and authority. The fourth option is to ordain only pastors to the one office of Word and Sacrament and have no other authorized ministries in the church, but to let all others exercise their ministry as members of the ministry of the baptized. Only this last one really denies legitimate authority to any but the ordained. It is defended on the basis of the integrity and personal competent authority of each individual Christian. The other options I've mentioned all grant varying measures of a legitimate authority to many ministers. It may be that we'll come back where we started from, but I think there really are legitimate options to choose from. I took a long walk yesterday with someone, and we talked about theology. And he said that his wife often says that perhaps that theologians spend an awful lot of time talking about what kind of cheese the moon is made of, when most of the people in the world know that the moon isn't made of cheese at all. It may be we've spent an awful lot of time here talking about legitimate authority in the church, and there may not be all that much to go around. And maybe a lot of people on the outside know it. To maintain legitimate authority of the ordained ministry and of other ministries in the church, I propose, as I've proposed before, is really a kind of countercultural effort. People are not likely to take anyone's word for anything. People, by and large, in a highly rational culture, need to be convinced one by one. People, as you know, if they disagree, leave either quietly or noisily. But I want to put in one more good word for authority. I think it is needed for the passing on of the faith. Not everything that we need to know can be proven or demonstrated by rational means. Some of what we need to know for our life and for our salvation is the accumulated wisdom of the ages that we receive by trust. Some of it is revelation that we receive by faith. Not everything can be decided by vote or by the political process of competing interest groups. The Christian church has a service to offer to the modern world, not to deny the scientific method or the democratic process, not to encourage people to quit questioning and to give in a kind of slothful way to doing what they're told. But we have a service to offer in offering a corrective to the individualistic society in which we live and in offering the possibility of trust. The possibility of trusting others chosen by us with the responsibility to tell the truth and to hold them accountable for the truth that they tell. I challenge you to be part of that community who is rebuilding the web and the fiber of our church and society. God bless you.